So it's a great pleasure to be here, and I want to thank the organizers for giving me an opportunity to talk about the subject, which does not seem to be immediately related to the conference theme, but I'll try to argue that in fact it is. So the kind of things that I will be discussing today can be thought of as some kind of quantum engineering, namely how to take regular atoms, bosons or fermions, and design exotic phases, like engineers design machines with properties that they want. We want to design quantum phases that we like. So this work has been done. Essentially, all the work I will present today has been done together with my Harvard colleague, Misha Lukin, and we were fortunate to collaborate with several people, Yehud Altman, Walter Hofstadter, Adilet Imambekov, Luke Massey, Anders Sorensen, Charles Wang, Fei Zhou. In fact, two of them are here, Walter Hofstadter and Fei Zhou. So in the last few years, we've seen a lot of excitement in the field of ultra-cold atoms. And that's one of the reasons we have a workshop running in parallel on cold gases. But let's say, just for maybe non-experts in the audience, let me go back to some of the first experiments, which saw both Einstein condensation of alkali gases. So this is the time of light measurement. And I'll come back to this kind of measurement throughout my talk, so let me explain it in detail. We start with atoms confined in a trap, let's say magnetic trap. At some point, the trap is removed, and atoms start flying out with velocities which they had inside the trap. And after some time, the atoms expand to distances much larger than the original size of the trap. So essentially, the original velocities of the atoms were converted into the atom position. So if we take an optical image after this time of flight, we actually get the distribution of atoms according to their velocities inside the trap. If we have a Bose-Einstein condensate, then we expect a macroscopic occupation of atoms in the state of smallest kinetic energy, let's say for simplicity, state of zero velocity. And so the central peak, which you can see appearing at low temperatures, is exactly this macroscopic number of atoms in the condensed state. So an advantage of atomic systems is, of course, that they are very low density. And so interparticle distance is orders of magnitude larger than the scattering length. So this is a regime of when interactions are weak and can be described very nicely in a theoretical framework. So one of the intriguing developments of the last few years is that people learned that atomic systems can be also pushed into the regime of strong interactions. And for example, in probably the last year, most of the attention was on Feshbach resonance, in which the scattering length becomes very large, comparable to the interparticle distance. And that is what gives rise, say, to the condensation of diatomic molecules. Well, there is another way of increasing the strength of interaction between atoms, which relies on using optical lattices. So the idea is quite beautiful and basically works the following way. So again, we start with atoms in a trap. And then we, in addition to this overall confinement, we make standing laser beams. So the standing laser beams create an oscillating electric field. So atoms interact with electric field by the AC Stark effect, so they get polarized, and then this polarization interacts with the electric field. So essentially, the potential experienced by the atoms is quadratic in the electric field. Since electric field is periodic in a standing wave, we have a periodic potential for the atoms. And in fact, by increasing the strength of the laser beam, we can make this optical potential very large. So in particular, we can go into the regime in which these sort of wells for individual atoms are very deep. And so atoms are really forced to spend all of their time sort of at the bottoms of these wells. And so we enhance interactions between atoms just because we sort of we make them to sit on top of each other. And in fact, in this regime, it's safe to assume that we only need to worry about the lowest state inside the individual wells, and what is left from kinetic energy is essentially tunneling between the neighboring wells. So an appropriate model in this regime is the Bose-Hubbard model, in which we have atoms tunneling between the sites, and we have interaction of atoms sitting on the same site. And so by just changing the intensity of the laser beam, we can dramatically change parameters of the system. Actually, probably the largest effect. So the largest effect is on tunneling, because it depends exponentially on the strength of the potential. And so if the laser, if the optical lattice is weak, we're in the regime in which kinetic energy dominates. So it's some kind of super, it's the usual state when interactions are weak. But when we make the laser intensity strong, tunneling gets suppressed and interaction dominates. So not surprisingly, in these two regimes, we have very different states of matter, right? If tunneling dominates, so the kinetic energy must be optimized. So we go into superfluid phase, which all the atoms, most of the atoms essentially go into the same state. But if we go into the regime of weak tunneling, actually interactions become more important. And so superfluid phase means strong particle number fluctuations inside the individual wells. And that's energetically unfavorable. The system is better off having a fixed number of particles inside individual traps. And that's the more insulating state. So this. How does one observe this transition? And that has been done in beautiful experiments by the Munich group. And the idea, again, is to use time of flight measurements. So again, we remove all the confinement, optical lattice, overall confinement, and let the atoms expand. So if we start from the superfluid phase, then we can think about this experiment several ways. Let's say we can still say that the system is superfluid, so atoms are in a state of the lowest kinetic energy. But now we have a lattice. So the lowest kinetic energy corresponds not to zero momentum, but zero quasi-momentum. And as you know, quasi-momentum differs from momentum by Bragg reflections. So this means that in it, not only we have macroscopic occupation of atoms in a state with zero wave vector, but also in states with all the at wave vectors of the reciprocal lattice. And so then when we do this time of flight imaging, we see these peaks basically at the wave vectors of the reciprocal lattice. We can also think about this as saying that, well, when the superfluid phase, we have coherence between the wells. So when we let them expand, it's just looking interference from a periodic array of coherent sources. So we get constructive interference. And on the other hand, when we go into the insulating state, then, of course, we have fixed number of particles in each well, so we don't have coherence. And so this constructive interference is gone, and we don't see any Bragg peaks. So many of the ideas which I'll be presenting today are really inspired by these beautiful experiments. And I'll suggest how one can use optical lattices to create even maybe even more exotic states of matter. So this is, of course, a list of subjects. I will not have time to go through it, so but I'll just go as far as I can, and I'll be happy to answer questions at the end if people want to hear about something particular. So okay, let's say the first subject I'll discuss is two-component Bose mixtures, and I also want to maybe point out right away what, let's say, from the point of view of condensed matter, physics, what are the interesting questions we can ask for these systems? So the interesting sort of perspectives we can gain from studying the systems is competition of several orders. That's what I'll discuss. And also, I'll try to argue that one can use the systems to realize models which may very well be fractionalized in dimension larger than one and without time reversal breaking. Then from two-component systems, I'll switch to three-component, which is naturally to associate with spin 1 bosons. And here, I will argue that there is a very interesting magnetic ordering which happens for the system, namely spin pneumatic ordering. And there are also, one can make some speculation that maybe in the system we will have pairing in even when we have purely repulsive interactions. And actually, this idea becomes even this idea of pairing with repulsive interactions becomes even more interesting when you think about fermions and optical lattices. So essentially, in this case, we're really dealing with the positive U-Hubbard model, which is the minimal model suggested for high-TC cuprates. And we still don't know whether there is pairing in this model. So one can think of this as a special purpose quantum computer for solving the high-TC. So then. Another interesting subject is to think about boson fermion mixtures, and in particular in one dimension. And here I will argue that again, we come to the question of competing orders. And also, we will see that some very interesting Polaronic physics comes in, which needs to be accounted for if we want to understand the systems. And that Polarons, again, is something which is quite an active area in solid state physics. So, so far we only talked about interesting effects of interactions, but one subject I want to raise is actually interplay of disorder and interactions, and that's atoms in magnetic microtraps. And in particular, well, it's sort of the idea of Bose glass phase has become a cornerstone of our understanding of, let's say, disordered systems, but we don't really have experimental verification of this Bose glass phase. So, let's say, Hillman-Vico, which was expected to be very close, does not look like a Bose glass. So I will try to argue that using atoms in magnetic microtraps, we can have systems which should be in Bose glass phase and that we can actually study this. And finally, I'll talk about realizing fractional quantum Hall states. Okay, so what's the simplest generalization of the simple Bosonic-Hubbard model? Well, let's just put two species of atoms. In fact, this has been done already. And the interesting aspect of the system is that actually the lattice for two species can be, so two species interact differently with different light polarizations. So effectively, I can change parameters of the optical lattice for the two species independently. And I can also play with magnetic field, or let's say just by moving sort of two lattices with respect to each other, I can also vary the effective interaction. Let's say interspecies or intraspecies interactions can be varied independently. So I get this remarkable flexibility to study this two-component Bose mixture. And I want to ask, well, what are the interesting effects which we can expect? Actually, so later in my talks, since I only have two components, I'll always call them up and down. So effectively, these are spin one-half bosons.
How do you vary the
use? For example, what you can do, you can, let's say, move two optical lattices with respect to each other, so the wave function overlap changes. And so then U up-down becomes much smaller than U up-up or U down-down. Or by playing with magnetic field, let's say you can approach a resonance for, let's say, particular, Feshbach resonance.
But that will change T also when you're changing the optical lattice. It will not change just T.
No, it doesn't. Yeah, you see, so the lattice, I'm just shifting, let's say, the down, the spin down lattice. Okay, so actually, let me ask a particularly simple question. I want to be inside an insulating phase, and I want to have exactly one atom per site. So in the kind of single species bosons, that was just a Mott insulator, which we discussed. But here, we still have a leftover degree of freedom, right, namely the spin. So atoms can have spin up, down. So what happens? What's the ground state? Well, we can say it's not a really relevant question because spin is conserved in the system, so the total number of up and down atoms is fixed by the initial preparation. But even that is not enough to fix the state of my system. Let's say I can imagine the following states, for example. In each well, I make a superposition of up and down atoms, right? So if we use analogy with sort of magnetism, that's clearly sort of a ferromagnetic state with magnetic order in the XY plane. And clearly, my average density is 1/2 per site. On the other hand, I can make, let's say, throughout my talk, I will call this, let's say, ferromagnetic state, but other people, let's say, like Boris Istanov, like to call it counterflow superfluidity, because it, even though it's a Mott insulating phase, but it sort of, it breaks, it allows sort of like the superfluid flows of up and down spins in the opposite direction. That's where the term counterflow comes from. But in my language, it will be just some kind of spin wave in the system. So I will stick to this kind of spin interpretation throughout my talk.
So if T up is not equal to T down, then every density can be different from 1/2, right?
Well, I mean, you see, sort of in some sense, the question of the ground minimizing the ground state with respect to polarization is meaningless. Polarization doesn't relax. If you prepared half of your system with spins up, half of your systems with spin down,
sure,
and you're just stuck with it.
It's a spin flow, because spin wave is just an elementary
spin. Well, yeah, spin flow, yeah. Goldstone mode. On the other hand, a different state I can think of is an anti-ferromagnetic state in which I just divide my system into two sublattices and put all the spin ups into one sublattice and all the spin down particles into the other sublattice. So how does the system decide which way to go? Well, that's the kind of question that condensed matter people are very good at answering. Basically, we said that in the mod insulating phase, we have particles localized, so the number of fluctuations in individual wells are suppressed, but they're not frozen out completely. So there are still virtual tunneling processes in which I start with two atoms, with one atom, say, in each well. Let's say just look at two of them. And then I virtually go to a state with two atoms in one well, and then one of the atoms comes back. And I can integrate out these processes and see, let's say, how much this virtual tunneling lowers the kinetic energy of my state depending on the spin orientation. And you can easily realize that I can, this way I can go from, depending on the parameters, I can be either in a ferromagnetic or in anti-ferromagnetic state. For example, let me start with a regime in which my interspecies repulsion is larger than repulsion between the same species. So then if I start with anti-parallel spin and they hop, one of them hops and they're on the same side, we get an intermediate state which has a very high energy, right? So clearly this process does not lower the energy too much. On the other hand, if spins are parallel, then it's actually beneficial, quite beneficial for them to hop on and off. And on the other hand, if I reverse sort of this ratio of you up down to you up up and you down down, then anti-ferromagnetic ordering is beneficial because now it's much easier for atoms to gain some kinetic energy. And I can also, again, by just changing parameters such as tunneling, I can go from easy axis anisotropy to easy plane. So one question one may ask is, well, how stable, how robust is this argument? Since I only worked sort of perturbatively in tunneling deep inside the mod insulating phase, will it survive if I approach the superfluid phase? And the answer is yes. So this is mean field plus quantum fluctuation, and you can see that these different magnetic phases survive all the way to the superfluid phase. In fact, something interesting happens at the transition between the anti-ferromagnetic and superfluid phase. Namely, this transition is actually first order, even though we're typically used to mod insulated to superfluid transitions being second order. Yeah. Plus quantum fluctuations.
Plus quantum fluctuations about the mean field.
Yeah. So we calculate the spectrum inside the state, and we add this quantum energy of these quantum fluctuations, and that's how we compare energies of different states.
The mean field sort of selects out some particular quantum states.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. We start with like.
More exotic.
Probably. We played with these ones. They were never low in energy. At least within our level approximation, mean field plus quantum fluctuations in this model.
But usually, when you're doing exotic physics, you don't worry about. I mean, I have not seen that. I have not seen that as a guiding principle in this conference.
Yeah. Good point. Well.
Why were you surprised that the anti-ferromagnetic?
Well, actually, frankly speaking, one of the motivation for us to look at this system was to say that to find a super solid phase, right? Because you start with a system that breaks translational symmetry, this Z anti-ferromagnet. And then you have a superfluid phase. So we thought, well, what if we melt this crystal? Maybe we will have some superfluid, but a leftover translational symmetry breaking. So that would be a super solid phase, which people were looking for. Well, unfortunately, the nature seems to prefer the first order transition. So only in this sense, it's surprising. Well, not surprising. It's not what we were hoping for. OK, but an important question one can ask is, how do you detect these phases? For example, let's say the anti-ferromagnetic phase is probably the least trivial. We cannot do neutron scattering on this atomic system, so we have to think of some other technique. Well, actually, let me argue that the time of flight measurement is a very powerful tool. So let me come back to a time of flight measurement for a single species boson. So that's the one we discussed before. So that's my original cloud, it expands, then we take an image and see it on the screen. And that's what we saw. If you look at it, so it doesn't have Bragg peaks, it's an insulating phase, but just look at it, it has a lot of noise in it, right? So basically, what we want to do is use an idea from mesoscopic physics, namely that the actual signal in your system isn't the noise. So what we want to do is we want to analyze the signal. Namely, we don't want to just look at the average density, let's say, at this point. But we want to ask, well, if I know that I found a particle here, what's the probability that I find a particle a certain distance away? So it's a second order coherence. And the reason why it's a useful tool is sort of obvious. So in a sense, this measurement is really kind of a collapse of a quantum mechanical wave function, right? So I start with this atomic system, right, which is described by some wave function. It expands, and then I do a measurement, right? So there's one electron which has a wave function, right? And then I just, by doing a measurement, I just sort of measure it at some particular position. It has a probability, right, a wave function to be somewhere. So in principle, with different probabilities, I could find it in different beams, right, in my detector. But in this measurement, I found it in this particular beam, right? Therefore, this measurement does not just average, right, this wave function. It really contains a lot of correlation information. So in particular, what one needs to look at is sort of, as I said, the second order coherence, so the probability of finding two particles a certain distance away. And then what one should find, even for the simple mode insulating phase, is actually the Bragg peaks. So the Bragg peaks for the mode insulating phase appear not in the density, in the average density, but in the second order coherence, and they're again separated by reciprocal lattice vectors. And actually, essentially, this kind of measurement and analysis has been done by Zoran Hantzbabich and collaborators recently in a system which had many particles for well. That's in a lattice, right? So it's a measurement in a lattice. So how is it useful for my problem of detecting the anti-ferromagnetic state? Well, it's simple, right? So basically, if, as I said, in the anti-ferromagnetic state, we separate the system into two sublattices. And so my period is twice the original. Original period of the system. And therefore, when I look at reciprocal lattice vectors, I get new peaks. And so, as I argued, that reciprocal lattice vectors appear in the second order coherence. So what one should find inside this mode insulating phase with anti-ferromagnetic ordering is the appearance of extra peaks due to the anti-ferromagnetic order. So this is really the analog of elastic neutron scattering. OK, well, just to show you that things can be made really exotic in the systems, let me just show that what else one can realize. So I talked about, let's say, modifying sort of spin, changing spin exchange interactions, making them Ising, let's say, making them along Z or X axis. But I always kept them at least the same in the entire system. Well, actually, it doesn't have to be the case. So what one can show is that using appropriately chosen laser beams, one can cook up a model of the following type, that I start with a hexagonal lattice, and let's say I color bonds which go in the same direction, in the same color. So I have blue and green ones and the red ones. And for all the blue bonds, I want to have Ising interaction in the X along the x-axis. For all the green ones, I want to have Ising interaction along the y. And for the red ones, I want Ising interaction along the z. So as I said, essentially, like with three sets of standing wave light beams, one can make this kind of systems. Well, it turns out that this is a system which is exactly solvable, solved by Kitaev, and he argued that it has fractionalization. And in fact, if one adds magnetic field, then the system will have non-abelian anions, which we heard about, which were discussed before as a useful tool for quantum computing. Okay, so let me now move to a different system from two-component boson mixture. I want to talk about.
Can you just say a few more sentences about that? So what do you need to get that system?
You have to, as I said, laser beams with choosing sort of phase shifts appropriately. So it was really like sort of an engineering design problem.
Just two-level atoms.
Two-level atoms, two internal levels, yeah.
And then how do you? Okay.
You have to choose polarizations accordingly. For three laser beams. And it would take me like the entire hour to just discuss it. It's the details are in our paper. Okay. So now, actually, so for three components, generically, I would have too many interactions. So let me stick to the simplest case in which we have sort of spin symmetric situation. So I really have spin one bosons without, let's say, for simplicity, in the absence of magnetic field. And so nothing breaks spin symmetry. So for the interaction, I can only have interaction which goes as charge squared or the spin squared. And so this spin-dependent interaction can be either positive or negative. So let's say for rubidium we have negative, for sodium positive. So I will only be interested in the positive interaction. And of course, I have a symmetry constraint in my system, namely all of my atoms are in the same orbital state. So my spin wave function has to be symmetric, which means that for each so the number of particles plus the spin has to be an even number. So now the question that we ask, in this model, what's the ground state, right? So again, we expect some kind of superfluid phases and insulating phases. And but let me try to argue that actually here the system is much richer. So in particular, for all the odd number of particles in dimension larger than one, we expect to find nematic phases. And these are phases which break spin symmetry, but do not break time reversal. So in a sense that spin does not acquire an expectation value, but only an operator which is quadratic in the spin acquires an expectation value. So actually for a single, this is really like realizations of the wave function that Jason Ho wrote for a single well with this spinner bosons. And another insulating phase which is possible is a spin singlet phase in which, let's say, atoms become maximally anti-parallel to each other. And clearly, so the way for all the atoms to be as anti-parallel as possible is to just sort of combine in a total singlet, but that is only possible if the total number of atoms is even. So that's why we have singlet phases for even filling fractions. And what is quite likely to happen is that there will still be these corners of the pneumatic phase before the system goes into the superfluid regime. So let me try to explain. Another interesting fact is that there is a simple superfluid phase which, let's say, breaks both, let's say, charge number and the spin symmetry, but it's quite likely, I think, that one may find a phase in which what gets condensed is not individual atoms, but pairs of atoms, and that would happen in these corners. But in this talk, I'll only discuss the insulating phases and magnetic ordering. So let me first explain where the pneumatic phase comes from. So again, we do the same kind of approach we discussed before. We start, let's say, with a state or with one atom per well. We integrate out virtual hopping, and we get some effective exchange interaction. It has the Heisenberg term. It has the biquadratic term. Both are negative, actually. So the system looks ferromagnetic. So the question one can ask is, well, why is the system not ferromagnetic? Why are the spins not pointing in the same direction? And actually, what is tricky is that the biquadratic term is larger than the Heisenberg exchange. That's not something we're used to in condensed metaphysics, but that's what happens in this system. And just because sort of the ratio of two J's is different, we get this new spin states. Let me explain why. Let me start with just two sides, two spins. Well, this is a problem I can solve exactly, right? I can classify, I have two spin ones, they can form spin 2, 1, or 0, and I can calculate the energy of the state. So let's say if spins are pointing parallel, total spin is 2, S1, S2 is 1. And on the other hand, if spins are anti-parallel, I have a total spin singlet, S1, S2 is minus 2. So if I only care about maximizing the Heisenberg term, then clearly my ferromagnetic orientation, spin 2, is low in energy. But actually, what I'm mostly concerned about is this biquadratic term. It has a larger prefactor. And S1, S2 squared does not care about the sign. It really cares about the magnitude. And the magnitude is larger for the singlet state. So the singlet, so the ground state of these two atoms with spin 1 is really a spin singlet. So if I just look at, let's say, a chain, for example, I know that each bond wants to form a singlet, but clearly two singlets cannot share a site, so my system has to find a compromise of some kind, and this compromise is a state in which on each bond I have a superposition of spin 0 and spin 2, which is the spin pneumatic state. Well, in fact, at a very mean field level, one can think of the state as saying, well, in each well I have, boson with spin 1, and it's in a state which is eigenvalue of SZ, which is an eigenstate of SZ, but with eigenvalue 0, right? So we break spin rotational symmetry because we choose Z axis, but we don't discriminate between plus Z and minus Z. That's why we do not break time reversal symmetry. So it's essentially like a unitary triplet superconductor. Yeah?
Why not both solid?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So in one dimension, as I understand, that's still a question which is not fully settled. So there is a suspicion that in one dimension, in one dimension, clearly there is a bond solid regime, but it's not known whether this pneumatic type phase, some kind of gapless phase, survives in one dimension. But in higher dimensions, as far as I know, when we start with, our mean field, we do quantum fluctuations, we see that our pneumatic state is fully stable. So at least we do not have a second order transition into a bond solid phase. Of course, there may be a first order transition. And we did not really analyze, this to full extent. There were some Monte Carlo results which suggest that in high dimension, it's a pneumatic phase. So it's not 100% known, but it seems quite reasonable. Okay. Well, in fact, point out that if I start thinking about states with even a number of particles, it's actually a more interesting problem because now it's kind of a situation unusual in condensed matter physics in the sense that spin value is not really fixed in individual well, right? So I can start with a state in which I have spin zeros in each well, and then they interact with each other and they scatter into a state in which I have spins two in each well, but they still combine into spin singlet. So my spin symmetry is still fully satisfied. So I have some kind of spin model in which my magnitude of the spin is not fixed, right? It's a dynamic variable. However, one can still analyze this problem, and what one finds is still a pneumatic phase with a weakly first-order transition. Okay, but so as many condensed matter people know, pneumatic phases have been discussed in various contexts in solid-state physics. One thing we were always lacking is sort of experimental probe, because you don't see any Bragg peaks from the pneumatic order. So how do you see it in experiment? So in particular, that's the question which we ask here. How do you see pneumatic order? Well, okay. So let me give you some of the ideas which we have. Basically, let me now add magnetic field. And if I look at the regime and see what happens. So if I start with, tunneling equal to zero, then I know, and I have, even number of particles per side, I know that I want to have a spin singlet, right? My exchanges are zero. But then as I increase magnetic field, I have level crossing from spin zero to spin two, then to spin four.
Magnetic field is coupled to the chemical potential for the boson?
I'm asking again this abstract question, true ground state. So let me forget about the conservation of spin. It's Zeeman coupling. It's Zeeman coupling. Simple Zeeman coupling.
To
Sz equals one boson.
And what is the number of bosons? Even number of
bosons. Even number of bosons, yeah. So that's why I can only have a change of magnetization from 0 to 2. I cannot have it 1. But the point is that I have this, for zero tunneling, at least I have this plateaus in magnetization, and it's a fully gapped phase. And so then even if I turn on tunneling, I expect this to be a robust phase for a while. And so this really blows into this kind of domains of fixed magnetization. And it's similar to, Senhill and Subir have discussed in the context of quantum rotor models. So. And actually, then if I make my exchange large enough, then I go into a cantate pneumatic phase. And a very similar situation happens for odd filling factors, except that now I have this magnetization plateaus at odd values of magnetization.
So I missed what was different from previous.
In the previous problems there was no magnetic field, but there was a true phase diagram, and there was a phase diagram in a sense of superfluid insulating. This is all insulating phase.
Yeah,
So inside the insulating phase, I'm saying I turn on magnetic field, what happens?
No, but also you had, I thought you had a chemical potential for...
Yeah, so now there is no chemical potential. I just fix the number of particles. I'm only changing magnetic field. And I find the true ground state. So I get this kind of lobes, but these are kind of spin magnetization lobes. So the number of particles doesn't change. And so what this would mean is that if I calculate magnetization as a function of magnetic field, there should be plateaus. And that's something that has been observed in condensed matter physics. But an important difference is, well, actually, in condensed matter physics, spin is not a good quantum number. Spins relax in very small times, like nanoscales, nanoseconds. So, but in atomic physics, spin is fixed. So let's say if I prepare my system with magnetization zero, it will stay with magnetization zero no matter what I do with my magnetic field. So it looks like we have done a useless exercise. Well, let me try to argue that it's not useless. Namely, if a magnetic field by itself doesn't matter, let's apply a gradient of the magnetic field. So essentially, it's a Stern-Gerlach experiment. Actually, for spin 1 boson, Stern-Gerlach experiment has been in a large trap without optical lattice has been done. And what people saw was just separation to spin 1, spin minus 1, and spin 0 sort of clouds. So let's say 1 on the left, minus 1 on the right, and spin 0 component somewhere in the middle. But basically, because of this sort of plateaus in my magnetization in the ground state, what will happen here is that instead of this simple phase separation, my magnetization as a function of coordinate along this trap will have these plateaus. And these plateaus is something one can check, and regions in between would be the sort of small regions of the pneumatic phase. Okay, so now let me shift gears. So from talking about magnetism, let me talk about, let's say, quantum Hall effect. And it's one of the exotic states that we know, and it's interesting to see it realized. So as you know, so in atomic physics, the first set of ideas had to do with, let's say, just rotations. And the problem there is that actually when you rotate, you sort of your atoms spread out, so that the density gets low, so the interaction scale becomes weak. So somehow, let's say again, we just want to think about getting a quantum Hall state, keeping interactions large. And as we know, optical lattices is a way to do it. But how can we use it for generating a quantum Hall state? Naively, well, you could say somehow what I need is some kind of flux through my lattice, right? But well, atoms are neutral, so you cannot apply. Magnetic field does not have orbital effect. So you have to think of something else. There were several proposals. Let me just discuss the one which we gave. And that is actually to use a combination of rotating quadrupolar potential and time-dependent hopping. So I can just, so basically what, if I think of this as my sort of quadrupolar potential which oscillates, I essentially turn on, let's say, my tunneling in the x direction for half a period, and then tunneling in the y direction for half a period. So then you can think about it the following way. Let's say when my jx is turned on, my quadrupolar potential looks like that. So it's, there is a force acting on atoms which sort of in this direction. And when my jy is non-zero, you can see that there is a force acting on the atoms like that. So if I average, you can see that there is like a force which makes atoms move in a circle. So it's like a Lorentz force. So this kind of arrangement mimics the effect of the magnetic field. And of course, one can make this argument more precise. So we know how to generate flux. The question is, well, do we get exotic phases, such as fractional quantum Hall states? Well, interestingly, when we... Our first reaction was, well, probably somebody looked at the system, right? Atom, some kind of bosons with a flux on a lattice, do they form fractional quantum Hall states or not? Well, we did not really find any numerical analysis, so we had to do it ourselves. So let's say in the regime when I have very small particle density, it's kind of a trivial, right? So you would say, well, it's if I have small occupation, I'm almost in the continuum limit. My atoms are at the bottom of the band. And in the continuum, it's very natural to expect quantum Hall states. But that's not the regime where we want to be, right? For small atom density, interactions are weak. So again, this fractional quantum Hall state is hard to observe. We want to have some respectful occupation number, like, I don't know, one quarter, or let's say at least one eighth density for atoms. And we want to ask whether we still find a fractional quantum Hall state in this regime. So the kind of analysis which we have done is actually very simple. So we take Hartree bosons, and we fix the effective filling fraction at 1/2. So that's the number of atoms divided to the number of fluxes. And then there is a flux density. And so as we increase the flux density, because nu is fixed, we increase the particle density. And then we do something which is really naive. We take a wave function, just a Laughlin wave function, right, in the continuum. It's not optimized to lattice at all. And just we solve finite systems, and we find an overlap with this Laughlin wave function. Well, not surprisingly, for small occupation numbers, where the system is essentially like in the continuum, the overlap is like is essentially 100%. But what is quite interesting is that we can go to fairly large occupation numbers. The overlap is still respectable, let's say around 90 or 85%. And that's not a coincidence. Let's say at this point, for five particles, our Hilbert space is 100,000. And still, our overlap is 85%. So it's quite remarkable. And we think it's a strong indication that the atoms in this regime are in the fractional quantum Hall state. And it's, this wave function may not be such a crazy way of describing it. And it's also, again, for just practical purposes, if we want to ask experimentalists to measure this quantum Hall state, they want to know what the gap is, how strong this quantum Hall state is. And what we find is that the largest gap is around this flux density of 0.2, and it's this respectable fraction of the tunneling J, and J is, let's say, typically in this kilohertz range. So it's actually it's a reasonable number which one can work with.
It looks like you almost have a phase transition for some value of alpha
there. Yeah. So So around, let's say, this alpha equals 1/3, and then especially, let's say, alpha equals 1/5, the overlap sort of goes to zero. We think it has something to do that, with the fact that at this point we're sort of hitting commensuration points for vortices. So it's very easy for them to form a lattice, and you go into the superfluid phase, essentially, because Hartree bosons can still be superfluid.
So it's equivalent to our Laughlin to Wigner transition, that just commensuration comes in here, or is it? This is purely commensuration.
Commensuration for vortices, not for bosons.
You don't have any Coulomb interaction.
It's Hartree bosons. Yeah, the simple. Yeah, it's just for this. Oh, I mean, actually, in the systems, you can generate local interactions, but non-local interactions is hard. Oh, so basically, nu is fixed to 1/2, and that's the flux density, right? So it goes from 0.1 to 0.2 to 0.3.
Is it because of you increasing the periodic potential, you're also increasing the effective interaction?
No, so we just fixed interactions, hardcore, right? So it just simplifies, it makes Hilbert space small for numerics.
No, but what I mean is the lattice effect becomes stronger.
If, like,
increasing alpha, but also interact more because there are more.
But that would be good for quantum Hall effect.
Right, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that's maybe
why it's robust. Yeah, maybe that's a good point. Yeah.
Less sensitive to alpha.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good point. Okay, so I talked about interactions. Let me bring up this issue of interactions and disorder, right, which, as we know, is quite an interesting subject. So there is one system which is quite popular in atomic physics, and that is magnetic microtrap. So the idea is, actually, I think it started as really practical motivation, just trying to make one-dimensional waveguides for atoms. And a simple way suggested for this was to sort of run a wire on the surface of a chip, like semiconducting chip. And then if there is a current through the wire, there is magnetic field. And then I also have an extra magnetic field. So there is really one line at which two magnetic fields cancel each other. Now I take my atoms, which are, let's say, low field seeking atoms. And so they have the minimum of their potential on this line. So I get a one-dimensional condensate. So that was the idea. And, well, let's say to avoid the singularities which appear when magnetic field is equal to zero, one typically adds an offset field. Well, people have done these experiments, and they found something quite interesting, that actually, instead of sort of this nice one-dimensional condensate, the condensate seems to break into some kind of puddles. And these puddles are sort of halfway between being random and periodic, right? So that's this sort of profile of the density. So there is no periodicity, they don't look completely random. There is really like a length scale of some kind. So first, So the a natural reaction is, well, this has to do with some kind of fluctuations in the wire, but let's see, then why is there a length scale? Well, actually, that sort of the idea is very familiar to people in condensed matter, right? Well, let's see, in semiconductors, when we're looking at disorder induced by doping layer, there is a length scale of disorder which is set by the distance between, let's say, two-dimensional electron gas and this dopant layer. So the same works here. If one works through the Biot-Savart's law, one finds that actually, even if one starts with some kind of random fluctuation which do not have length scale for the wire shape, then by the time one sort of when one measures the magnetic field fluctuations, a distance h away from the surface, one finds that short wavelength fluctuations go away, long wavelength fluctuations go away because of Biot-Savart's law, so we're left with fluctuations predominantly on the length scale of h. And in fact, this has been explicitly checked by Alan Aspect's group, in which they just did, following the suggestions, they did an explicit calculation for, let's say, a known wire. They just took a real image of the wire. They calculated, used Biot-Savart's law to calculate a random potential, and then measure it for that particular microchip, and they found this very nice agreement. Okay, so this random potential actually means bad things for practical applications. It makes it very difficult to use these waveguides for doing interferometry, but what we want to argue is that it makes it fun for fundamental physics. And namely, one can make very simple estimates and say that, and argue that it's possible to bring atoms in these microchips to the regime where we expect a system to become in a Bose-Glass phase. Because essentially what happens is that as we just decrease the current in the wire, right, our sort of position of minimum of magnetic field goes down, so length scale of disorder becomes larger, and disorder by itself gets larger. And so if we just, one just has to lower the atom, the density below to what is used in experiments, but not to some crazy numbers, and we should be in the regime in which we expect to see a Bose-Glass phase. Well, so now the question is, how do we see it? So let me just suggest one particular experiment, which is a shaking experiment. And it's actually, so don't be confused by the name, it's shaking does not mean that we're sort of shaking with a certain frequency. What we do is, so we start with this fragmented condensate, and there's an overall confining potential, and we shift this confining potential once by a certain distance, right? And then we just look at how these puddles, how the atoms respond to the shift of the potential. So if we're inside the superfluid phase, well, we expect, and the shift is small, we expect to just excite some kind of small oscillations of our superfluid, most likely dipole modes. And that you can see in, let's say, power spectrum. If one just takes real-time image, like, so this is what we have done numerically. So if one takes real-time image one and takes, let's say, a power spectrum, one sees like the frequency of the dipole mode and some of its higher harmonics. But interesting things start to happen as one makes displacement even larger. Right, at some point, one finds that actually the spectrum changes. Instead of, let's say, like one mode and its harmonics, one sees a whole bunch of modes, right, which are not really related to each other. So one gets into some kind of chaotic regime, and it's not surprising, right? So collective excitations are defined for small fluctuations, but they are really nonlinear. So if sort of the system has to fluctuate a lot, we basically start seeing nonlinearity. All the oscillations get coupled, and that's what we see. But something even more interesting happens if we make displacement yet larger. So then if one looks at power spectrum, and then one concentrates on, let's say, one part of the sample, one sees just like one or two frequencies. And then one moves to a different part of the sample. Again, one sees a couple of frequencies and their harmonics. But frequencies at this point have nothing to do with frequencies at that point. It's like the system really decouples into different segments which don't talk to each other. OK, I'm almost done. So that's actually what we called self-trapping. And in fact, what is even more bizarre is that these fluctuations occur around some extremely non-equilibrium configuration. Density is not more or less uniform. There is like huge regions of very high densities and regions of very low density. And it's around this very non-uniform distribution that the system oscillates. And so there is a simple physical argument that one can give. But OK, I'll skip it. And now the question is, but that was sort of simulations in this superfluid classical regime. The question is, what happens once we go to Bose-Glass phase? So that's the regime in which it's hard. We did not do any, I guess, so here we really solve just classical equations of motion. Here one has to take into account quantum mechanics. Our best guess is that we will be in self-trapped regime because it's an insulator, right, both glass. The system should be fairly local, and this self-trapping regime is what looks very local. So, and so what this suggests for experiments is to just, let's say, do the sort of shaking experiments at some very small displacement and then change the strengths of disorder, which, as we said, can be done easily by just bringing the condensate closer to the chip. And then one should see a change from the dipole type oscillations to this kind of self-trapped regime. Okay, so my time's up, right? So I guess I just put transparencies. Unfortunately, I had only time to talk about some of the subjects, about two component Bose mixtures, about spin one bosons. I did not talk about fermionic atoms. I did not talk about boson fermion mixtures. And I talked about fragmented condensates. In magnetic microtraps and fractional quantum Hall states of ultra cold atoms in optical lattices. Thank you.
Well, it's time for questions.
Two questions. In the beginning, when you talked about the two component systems and the easy plane, so this is very much like the bilayer electron gas. Is there, in the bilayer case, is there any possibility of finding the easy axis antiferromagnetic phase?
Easy axis antiferromagnetic. Yes, actually. So imagine that you take, instead of, let's say, quantum Hall systems, let's say you take chains, like just two chains. So again, because of the interaction between the chains, they would go into the analog of this easy axis antiferromagnetic.
But I mean at filling factor one, though.
At filling factor.
Is this some kind of lock charge density waves in the two layers, right?
That would be, yeah. I actually, so you're saying maybe. But you want to be at nu equals one. Well, I guess, so let's say if you make d over L larger, that's what the Hartree-Fock would predict, right? You have this charge density wave out of phase with respect to each other. Yeah, that's true.
And the second question was even more knowledge-free. This condensate fragmentation that you're talking about, is this possibly related to this fragmentation of these exciton luminescence rings that are seen by Putov and others?
I mean, it's a simple effect. It's just, yeah, it's random potential. But actually, no, I guess in their case, they claimed it was happening because of dynamical instabilities, right? Even for disorder-free systems, they would observe it. So probably disorder plays a role. Here, it's sort of, it's fairly trivial. It's just you have this random potential, and you can estimate what it is. You put in realistic numbers, like for the wire fluctuations, you find that the fluctuation of the potential are comparable to the chemical potential. So clearly, if sort of your potential rises above the chemical potential, then you sort of break your condensate into two puddles. So I think that's a much simpler effect.
The mapping that you did to the Kitaev honeycomb model, can you just elaborate on this a little bit? Meaning, let's say that I want to be bold, very bold, and I want to do topological quantum computation with that. What are the manipulations that are necessary for your system? How difficult are they as a matter of principle and so on? I mean, I'm not asking you to answer any experimental questions, but as a matter of principle.
No,
I think before you get to that, perhaps you could say a bit more about how you create the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, okay,
oh,
mapping
so,
itself.
So,
yeah, maybe you can answer, first tell us the mapping itself. We went too fast for that.
No, it's basically, it's sort of, it's really sort of an engineering question which you do. You have to use three sets of laser beams, and you have to choose their phases appropriately.
Okay, is it too difficult to find the thing?
I
would have said that.
Is it in principle possible?
The atmosphere honeycomb ladder.
The yes to that question.
The animal is sitting on the sides of the honeycomb ladder.
Yes. So,
and
okay.
There are what, both species on each side? Or, well, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, so basically, yeah. So, so more precise. Let's say you start with the first laser to, let's say, make a two-dimensional system. You make, then you use three lasers to just make a honeycomb lattice. Then you use three lasers, which in these three directions, which have finely tuned polarizations. And also you use a combination of magnetic fields. That's what I should have used.
So seven lasers and how many magnetic fields?
That's only one.
No, I mean, I really
want to
know.
So
I really want to know.
I guess, so you would, I think you will have to have magnetic field, which let's say D is different on, let's on different sides. So yeah, it has to be some modulated magnetic field. But again, it doesn't have to be a true magnetic field. But it's not. It doesn't have to be a true magnetic field. You just have to make a potential which acts differently on different species.
Well, that's another laser.
So that's another laser.
Look, all
these particles don't commute with each other. So in what sense is the entire?
Well, I mean, the claim was that if you take this model, he can write a solution for it. And it's fractionalized. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that, this is the Kitaev model, the original model. It's, you are thinking of a different Kitaev model. There are too many Kitaev models.
This is an interesting one.
Yeah. This is a very interesting one, yes. Okay, good. Kitaev actually talked about it here.
So anyway, all you can talk
is... Yeah, now, okay, so let's say we have this. Don't be shy. All topological quantum computation is impossible. I'm trying to see the level under your house. Yeah. I'm just, we are, you know, it's very, very like, my, you know, it's a minutia. How impossible is it? Is what
okay, so I guess, okay, but your question is, so how many laser beams?
Okay, so eight, you told us
okay,
that.
Okay, eight.
What manipulations do you need? So this
oh, how to see it? That right. It's a Kitaev state, right. That it's fractional state. That I don't know. That I'm quite, we're quite open about.
Also.
We tried to think about it. We did not come up with...
Oh, so even under all these things, you can't tell us whether it is or not. That's
true. Well, but in some, the first challenge was to just ask, well, if by sort of playing with all, if, and so you discover that you can design sort of this spin exchange Hamiltonians, which mm-hmm. are interesting. So then, I know, you set yourself an ultimate challenge. So our ultimate challenge was to make this model, and that's what we achieved. But yeah.
So there is still more thinking that could be done on this.
Yeah, definitely.
It's an engineering problem.
Quantum engineering.
About the spin one model in the Mach limit, I think Eugene, I think may be useful to since you talk about the different phases in increasing magnetic fields, I think it would be useful to consider the quadratic Zeeman effects, which turns out to be quite sizable. And that may change some of the phase structures. The other comment is that in case one's interested in field gradients, and turns out in general, field gradient would also trigger another type of Hamiltonian, which, i.e., just to interchange one and minus one. I mean, but which actually one may be able to make use of it to manufacture some of the interesting Hamiltonian. And the final comment is to respond to. Jim Eisenstein's question: there are, in fact, efforts in various laboratories to make to cut a rotating condensate with the lasers, optical lattice, and certainly there are cases that one can produce bilayer systems of similar filling factors. So there could be analogs, direct analogs to the things that you are interested in.
Okay, so I guess I'll just respond to this quadratic Zeeman effect. So this spin-dependent term is fairly weak, and that's why, so you don't need really large magnetic field gradients. So if you take some kind of realistic system sizes, so what our estimate showed that quadratic effect should not be large. So you can make it large by making the magnetic field gradient larger. But there is a regime in which you can see as a sort of plateau physics, and quadratic effects are not important.
The quadratic Zeeman effect is to be distinguished with the field gradient. It has nothing to do with field gradient. The quadratic Zeeman effect is related in solid state physics, we are used to the fact that the magnetic moment of an atom is constant, but in atoms, because the hyperfine interaction.
I understand what you're saying.
I thought you meant I understood.
No.
But I think your category would tell you how.
You have to control momentum field quite accurately.
Yeah,
that's true. That's probably one why this may be a challenge.
Yeah, I get a little bit nervous because you keep increasing magnetic field as well. That's why.
But I mean, we just really need a gradient which is not too large, because it's sort of this U2 term, which comes from the difference of the scattering lengths, is very small by itself.
So these multi-component condensates you talked about, can you give some estimate of these exchange energy scales? Is it something that can be realized in experiments easily?
Basically, you can think that you can tune, so this typical values of, let's say, T, like, let's say, kilohertz, and then you can change from being much smaller, much larger. So I would say it's the same range of kilohertz frequencies. Tens of kilohertz.
Hey. I want to make a comment about the effect of quadratic Zeeman term and external field, external magnetic field in general. Eugene already mentioned part of the, in part of his talk, mentioned those effects. So I think the spin singlet does not stay, actually is stable with respect to linear Zeeman effect, but it's not stable with respect to quadratic Zeeman effect. So in the sense that when you apply quadratic Zeeman term, then the magnetic order will be induced. So this is something we recently looked at. And
but that depends on the numbers.
Pardon?
It depends on the numbers, right? So yeah, if you have to control magnetic field, let's say of the order of milligauss,
yeah,
for this to be negligible.
If you start with singlet, it's always, there's a finite matrix element between the, I mean, quadratic term can introduce a finite matrix.
Yes, but it depends on the magnetic field. So I'm saying for fields of the order of milligauss, this is not a relevant term. It's so small that you can forget about it. And it's hard to make magnetic control magnetic fields at this accuracy, but that, possible in principle.
Well, I mean, practically maybe that's different. So I'm saying the phase is unstable around that direction.
Any more questions? Okay, then we'll thank you, Gene, and close the session.